Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, June 3rd, 2017. This is Earth Ancients. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. Hey, it's June. What? What's going on, man? June? June 3rd? Saturday, June 3rd? God, I mean, the year's flying. It's crazy how fast things are going. I'm glad June's here because things warm up a little bit, and it's been cold here in Northern California. So looking forward to summertime. A few more weeks and the summer is officially here, but I'm still shocked it's June. Hey, if you were listening to Andrew Collins last week and you were interested in learning more about this alien megastructure on Cygnus, the Cygnus star, I have a short article he wrote and a really, really cool picture of what we see from our distant telescopes. And this image is pretty cool. You actually see the planet itself, and there's a band. There's this black band of, they don't know what. They're guessing or hypothesizing. And this is not only Andrew who's hypothesizing. These are serious scientists, noted scientists who are saying, hey, this is an alien megastructure. But it's just really weird to hear scientists say that. This photograph shows the planet, and then there's this band of solid black that goes across it. It's a perfect band. And this is the whole hypothesis behind a star-sucking, energy-sucking band of these structures, some kind of an artificial structure that's wrapped around the planet. And it's 1,300 light years away from Earth. So we really don't know what we're looking at until we get more telescopes up there. And apparently we have another telescope that's going up in the next year. So we'll get closer to seeing what's going on. So if you want to see the full details of what Andrew's talking about in this Cygnus megastructure, alien megastructure, you can go see it on Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, and go to the group page. Very, very cool. I spoke with Andrew earlier this week, and he's going to be back on the program to talk in greater detail about this megastructure and also how it's been influencing Earth cultures for thousands of years. It's kind of an interesting interview we had. I was speaking to our guest today, and he lives in Mexico City, and I was talking to him about these white roads that are found in Yucatan and other parts of Maya lands. They're down in Belize. So you can see them in Honduras at Copan. Wherever there's a major Mayan city, they have these very long, very big white roads or white ways called, otherwise known as scabies. And these are these engineered Mayan roads. And they're engineered to such a level that they last hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of years. And the real curious thing about these roads is, especially in Yucatan, where I've spent a great deal of time, when you look at these cities, like say we look at Chichen Itza or Coba or even Tulum, which is right on the edge of the Caribbean Ocean, it's right on the beach side. You can see these roads from a satellite, and a lot of them go right into the water. And about a year ago, I was studying a bunch of satellite photography that I had taken from Google Earth, and I noticed that not only do they go into the water, but in some cases, especially northern Yucatan, just above Cancun, you can see these roads going for hundreds of yards or feet, actually yards. And this brings up a question of possible other cities. Now, there hasn't been a great deal of underwater archaeology on these white roads and you know, diving to see if there's anything there. But I haven't, I mean, I've seen five or six of these roads go right into the water and then go fairly deep, and then you can't see them anymore because it's just too deep in the water. So this is a curiosity, and I mean, somebody has got to consider this. And, you know, if they do find a city underwater, which I think is a likely chance, this changes the age of the Maya. It changes our dating and our understanding. A number of research investigators and authors, including scientists, believe that during the last catastrophe, the Younger Dryas period, the sea level rose several hundred feet. In some cases, Randall Carlson says it rose over 400 feet. And if that's the case, it probably ate up a lot of land around the world. My speculation is that the Yucatan Peninsula was much larger prior to that event. And these roads show evidence that there could be cities that are buried underwater. So that's something that came up today. And of course, it made me think of the trip we're taking in October, Maya in Mexico tour. From October 28th to November 4th, we're going to be journeying down to the Yucatan Peninsula. Hey, we're going to be staying at Mérida at a 4-star hotel, and we're going to be visiting, you know, some of the best known and not so well known cities throughout that area. I don't know if anyone has been to Chichen Itza, but you got to check out Chichen Itza. I mean, that place is amazing. Sahil, Coba, Ekbalam, Uxmal, and this is an opportunity to see these ancient places up close and personal. I've got a really great rate for it. I think it's almost half off compared to the last price. It's $1,600 for the full week, and that covers pretty much everything except for your flight. If you want to know more about this tour, go to earthancients.com and go to the tour page. You can see the entire itinerary. It's something really to consider. And it made me think about this when I was talking to our guest today. And there's just so much to see down there. And there's so much that we just don't know. He's located in Mexico City. His name is Marco Vergato, and we'll talk to him a little bit later in the program. But Mexico has just thousands of years of history that's buried, and we know very, very little about it. So come join me. Come join me in October, October 28th through November 4th. EarthAncients.com, more information. And every week we post a number of articles, galleries of ancient locations, and links to articles of interest from around the world. This week I posted an interesting article from the British Museum. You know, we're always talking about ancient man, pre-Diluvian cultures, but what do these people look like? And a forensic specialist took a skull from Jericho, which is in the Middle East, and apparently it's dated at 9,500 years old, and they did a complete 3D reconstruction of what this individual looked like. So this is a chance to see what people look like almost 10,000 years ago, and it's quite unusual. This individual, he looks like us. I mean, he's a humanoid, but there's something about him that's kind of interesting. And you can see the complete article. You can see the whole thing on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients Facebook. Go to the group page. I'd like to see more of this kind of thing. And they can do 3D reproductions now with skulls much quicker. They've figured out a way to determine where the muscles attach to the skull, how the skin would lay across it. And this is a beautiful, beautiful reproduction of a human male, who is 9,500 years ago. So check that out. Check out the article, too. The way they reconstructed the face based on the skull is pretty amazing. They found a megalithic Stonehenge in Armenia. It's dated at 7,500 years old. Scientists had known about this, but apparently a number of the stone megaliths that make up the circle were buried. And it appears it's one of the oldest observatories in that part of the world. It's these circular stones, kind of circular like Stonehenge, but they don't know really the specific date. It could be much, much older than 7,500 years. They found and they dated some organic material in the area, but a lot of people are thinking it's much older. What they have come up with, though, is that the observatory was for sighting the sun, the moon, and other celestial bodies. Pretty cool when you see this. You can see a series of photographs that we have on the Facebook page. It's actually not as cleanly cut as Stonehenge. They're very raw stones, but they're huge. Some of them weigh half a ton, and you can see the entire selection on Facebook. Hey, a new DNA study has just come out. Scientists in Egypt looked at 151 Egyptian mummies that date between 1400 BC and 400 AD and found that they relate very closely to ancient European populations. And this is something that's kind of interesting. For a long time, scientists thought that these Egyptians were African-based people and had come from African populations. But as it turns out, the vast majority from this selection, and a lot of these are nobles, noble people, are from Neolithic Europe. So that's very interesting. And for me, I have always thought that the Egyptians were from various parts of Africa. So interesting DNA study. I have a very good video that I just posted about 3 days ago on the Peruvian city of Calvin de Hunter, which is in lower Peru. And these side scans that were created show not only the exterior of the building, but they show the interior. And there's a number of very large standing stones that are beautifully carved. The scans show how the rooms were created out of megalithic sized stones. And these scans that they do provide us with more information on how the buildings were created. It gives us an idea of what they were thinking. And there seems to be a partial observatory that's within the building. They don't really know how it was designed. They only have these outlets that point to the heavens. So you can see that and all of our other news posts on the Facebook page. Go to Facebook, go to Earth Ancients, and go to the group page, and you'll see the whole thing. So this segment, we have information on Native American movements. If you're interested in ancient America, you got to get this online magazine. It's called People of One Fire, and it's produced by Richard Thornton. We've had Richard on the program before, but this is some really amazing news that he just posted. There's a number of petroglyphs in and around the mountains of Georgia. And he, Richard Thornton, found that there was a series of petroglyphs that he could not interpret. So he brought in a specialist, and what he discovered is quite fascinating. And here's what Richard had to say about it. So I have Richard Thornton on with me, and Richard we've had on before. He is a professional architect, city planner, author, and also an expert on migrating early native tribes into the Americas, and he and I both believe that the Maya moving into the Northern American area, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and there's a lot of evidence for that, also Oklahoma. And I wanted to talk to Richard about an article that he published just recently, and the title of this article is "Archaeologist Garth Norman Interprets Molehill Petroglyphs in Marble Hill, Georgia."
Yeah.
And I read this article, and I was pleasantly surprised. Richard, how are you? Nice to have you back.
Thank you, sir. I'm doing fine. Hope you're well.
Yeah. So this article is wonderful in that not only does it describe, this is a classically trained archaeologist describing what he believes this interpretation is, but it's really confirming that the Maya actually were in the Northern America area. Can you talk a little bit about what Garth found in this petroglyph?
This is most of the petroglyphs that I've been studying in North Georgia. I can pretty much determine the meaning. In fact, most of them actually are identical to what you'll find in northwestern Europe, and they're very old. But this one baffled me, and I that's why I put out a call for help. I had no idea what it meant, and Garth has spent his life studying petroglyphs, both in the United States and in Mesoamerica, and I trust his judgment. Whatever he said is, I took his word for it, is that being a calendar. And then, you know, I just had no clue. But he's been doing that all his life.
We should probably just let people know that Garth is an archaeologist. He specializes in archaeoastronomy, which means that he would be able to, you know, study these petroglyphs and kind of know what their focus is. And he has studied for over 50 years.
That's correct. All his entire life he's been working with the Maya sites. And
yeah,
also the Southwest.
Yeah.
Yes, both areas.
Well, he's with the New World Archaeological Foundation, which is, I guess they really know their stuff. So anyhow, he was looking at this. You called him up, and what did he have to say about this petroglyph?
So your listeners will understand what's going on. The Itzas were not ethnic Mayas. They originally spoke another language. They came under the domination of Teotihuacan around 200 AD, and so their royalty spoke Totonac, which is the language of the elite of Teotihuacan, which was actually called Tula. That's what the town was called. And so the Itza language contains a lot of Totonac words. So that's why the Itza would be up at Teotihuacan. They were probably, you know, a delegation was sent from their homeland in Chiapas to Teotihuacan in central Mexico because their king was from Teotihuacan. That makes more sense. Okay.
Yeah. I'm really impressed in this because he actually says here, I'm going to read from what he said. He says, the date in question ties the Toltec calendar at Chichen Itza, Yucatan, where the pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, Serpent of Light on the stairway, records this information. So he actually relates it to Yucatan Peninsula. So that's the real amazing part of this article.
Well, can I explain again what was going on? You said I was an expert on migrations, so I might as well show my expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of Yucatan. The Itzas were in the mountains of Chiapas, which look more or less like North Georgia, except where there are volcanoes. And yet, when the Maya civilization as a whole collapsed, the Itzas migrated, some of them migrated up to northwestern Yucatan and took control of Chichen and then renamed it Chichen Itza. So that's why you would have that Chichen Itza also, that this wherever these Itzas went. They were different ethnic group, and there were actually many different types of Mayas, but think of them as, say, being Anglo-Saxons or something like that, or Vikings. You know, they were separate ethnic groups that would go around and establish their own cities. So it all makes sense.
Okay. So what's the distance between, say, Chichen Itza and Georgia? That's a long walk.
You want me to tell you exactly? I'll go on Google Maps.
No. I'm just wondering. I mean, they would have had to go around.
It's not actually. It's actually back in those days. See, land travel in the Americas was very slow. They had no horses or wheels.
Yeah.
And so, actually, it's very easy to get from Chichen Itza to Georgia because it's all by boat.
That's what I was going to ask you. So they probably would boat across the Gulf, right?
Well, it's not even, 90 miles between Cuba and Florida? And then, I mean, it's mostly just skipping from land to land to land. It's not that hard to get there. And then you go up the Chattahoochee River that goes all the way to Georgia gold fields.
Right.
Where we have a lot of its activity.
And we now know that the Maya were great mariners.
Well, the Itza Mayas were in the their cousins, the Chontal Mayas were. Most of the Mayas are afraid of water. But those two branches were great mariners, and they had sailboats that very similar to a Viking longboat. They could go anywhere. They could cross the Atlantic if they wanted to.
So that's a little heads up on what's going on. I mean, the decode on that whole interview is that they have found and continue to find evidence of Itza Maya and other types of Maya in the what is now Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi area. And you won't hear this in or read about this in history books, even though academic archaeologists are refining this material, are reporting it. It just takes forever to get the history books to get updated because it's a slow process. It has to be reviewed by groups of people, and then the books have to be acknowledged and so on and so forth. It could take 20 years when these discoveries come up. And this is really the frustration that I have for academic science, is that a lot of these archaeologists are finding really revealing aspects of our ancient past, and they cannot get it into the public's domain. And then it opens up all kinds of opportunities for these skeptics to say, well, that's all not true, it's BS. Well, it is true. And here's a archaeologist saying, hey, we have them here. So anyhow, I love to hear these kinds of things because it just validates the work that we do here on Earth Ancient. So it was fun talking to Richard. We're going to have him back in the future. So I like to hear from him. So my guest today is Marco Ligato, who's an Italian author and investigator, and he is really breaking open a lot of new information on megalithic cultures in Mexico. And he's been featured on Ancient Aliens when they discovered that he was a kind of an expert on a lot of these discoveries. And he's been on a lot of other TV shows regarding his tunnels that he's discovered too. And when I was writing the article on the pyramid of the serpent at Teotihuacan, I discovered that Marco had written an article about tunnels under pyramid of the moon and the sun and tunnel systems that ran for miles. And I wanted to know more about these. So I gave him a call, and here is our interview. A few weeks ago, I published an article in Ancient Origins magazine, And at the time, I hadn't really looked too deeply into what was some of the other articles that were featured in this magazine, which has been around for quite a few years. And the article I published, most of you know about, was on the observatory at Chichen Itza. But an earlier article that I had published in the same publication focused on the Pyramid of the Serpent, known as Quetzalcoatl, at Teotihuacan. And I discovered later that my guest today had written a number of articles at regarding Teotihuacan, and both of them were fascinating. And the focus of our show today is on Teotihuacan, but not just the standing buildings that we're familiar with. There apparently is a whole world of tunnels. There's a tunnel system that runs underneath Teotihuacan, which I had no clue about. Now, I did know, and it's been documented, that underneath the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan is a known tunnel. Most researchers don't know the purpose of this tunnel, but my guest today has actually done quite a bit of research. I really wanted to talk to him more about his research, and apparently he's been looking at these ancient megaliths that are there and studying the actual avenue, the actual function of this area for quite a while. My guest today is Marco Vigato. He has traveled extensively across Europe, Middle East, North Africa, Southeast Asia, and North and South America. And as an independent researcher of ancient mysteries and megalithic civilizations, he has really delved into and recorded through photographs and writing quite a bit about ancient history that isn't really known by the average person. So I'm really happy to have him on the show today. Marco, how are you?
Well, Cliff, thank you very much for having me on the show. Very good. Thanks.
Now, you're coming to us today from Mexico City, right?
That's correct.
Right. Fantastic. How did you get interested in Mesoamerican history? What was the starting point for you? Was it a book you read? Was it climbing the pyramids? What was the starting point for you?
Well, let's say I've always had an interest in ancient civilizations. So I visited Mexico the first time as a young child and became very quickly fascinated with pyramids and the origins, particularly of Mesoamerican civilizations. Then a number of life and personal circumstances made me move to Mexico about 2 years and a half ago. And that's the reason why I've been spending so much time here investigating the mysteries of Mexico's ancient past. I think there are a number of things that make Mesoamerican archaeology pretty unique that got me fascinated in the first place. I think, first of all, it's the lack of a very clear origins for Mesoamerican civilizations. There are lots of legends that speak of the arrival of foreign people, those gods who came from the sea in very remote times, like Quetzalcoatl, like Kukulkan, who were responsible for the foundation of these early civilizations, according to myth. And even if you look at the archaeological record, you have the impression there are lots of pages missing. Even in archaeological terms, it sounds like the earliest or some of the earliest Mesoamerican civilizations were the Olmecs, which are considered as the ancestors of most subsequent cultures, including the Mayas themselves. However, if you look at the remains that have been left behind by the Olmecs, you already see a pretty developed civilization. I would say that many of the examples that we have left of Olmec art, sculpture, and architecture, probably among the most sophisticated in both Americas. And so it's definitely interesting to see that at the very beginning of Mesoamerican civilization. And then, of course, you have so many mysterious sites whose origins are kind of shrouded in mystery, like Teotihuacan, for instance. We know very little about the origin and the culture of the builders of such sites, except, of course, for the impressive remains that they have left behind.
Right. Now, you must have climbed around and seen and have visited a number of these sites living in Mexico City. They're so close to you. And I have to say, and I'm interested in your impression, when I go, and I've been to Mexico a number of times and climbed and walked through these ruins, a lot of them are very extensively engineered. But not only engineered, as you say, a lot of them appear to have megalithic construction around them. So there's like a page of ancient Central American history that seems to be missing. Is that your impression?
Yeah, I think you touched a very good point, Cliff. I think the tendency in Mesoamerican archaeology has been very often to attribute some of these remains, particularly megalithic remains, to some of the already known civilizations, like the Olmecs, the Mayas, or the Aztecs. While what you find is, in fact, a much more mysterious past, I would say.
Yeah.
Let me give you a few examples. Of course, Teotihuacan is believed to have flourished around the first centuries of our era. However, there is evidence that the city itself was built upon much older ruins, much older remains, whose age is unknown. And that's where much of my more recent research has been focusing on. For instance, I found evidence of a megalithic layer of construction at Teotihuacan that might very well predate the classical metropolis that most tourists visit. And this is not the only remain of this kind in Mexico. There are a number of sites in central Mexico that show a very clear style of megalithic architecture, which is pretty much unknown in the rest of Mesoamerica, and that might be several centuries, perhaps millennia older than the known and perhaps like more famous remains of Mesoamerican civilizations. And this is definitely not a new thread of investigation. Already at the beginning of the 1900s, a number of archaeologists and explorers reported several anomalous finds in Mexico. Probably the most famous is this American geologist and archaeologist William Niven, who allegedly excavated a vast prehistoric metropolis in Azcapotzalco, just a short distance from Mexico City. These ancient metropolis, according to Niven, had laid buried for thousands of years, he speculates, as much as 10,000 years under volcanic deposits. And we're speaking of an enormous city. He speaks of a massive metropolis where he found remains of concrete floors and other pretty sophisticated buildings that had been laying buried under volcanic sediments for thousands of years. So if that's the case, there is indeed the possibility that an entire page of Mesoamerican history and archaeology still lays somehow forgotten under the layers of soil and rock in the Central Valley of Mexico.
Let me ask you, I have a understanding of megalithic building, usually very big stones. Andesite is a typical stone that seems to be very popular with a number of these megalithic builders in South America. You have actually reported that andesite is one of the primary stones. But for our audience, what is your definition of a megalithic builder in Central America?
Well, typically you would speak of some very large size stone blocks. Usually when you think of Mesoamerican architecture, you can hardly speak of megalithic construction. Most constructions, most buildings, even the more impressive pyramids of Teotihuacan are in fact built of rather inconsistent rubble and loose volcanic stone. So there is nothing really very sophisticated about the architectural technique itself. So to say, it's pretty small stone blocks loosely kept together with cement or just dirt or mud bricks. So the architecture itself is not very sophisticated. That's why it's even more surprising to find evidence of truly gigantic stone blocks. Some of the stone blocks that lay scattered around the Pyramid of Feather Serpents in Teotihuacan measure over 2 meters by side and probably have a weight in excess of 10 tons. So we're really speaking of some enormous stone blocks that would have required a very considerable effort both for quarrying and transportation. So this is what they really consider megalithic. Okay. And I think there are several examples of it around the Valley of Mexico, which are not only limited to very large blocks of stone that show and exhibit very fine workmanship, but you also have examples of monolithic architecture, which is a kind of different style of architecture even from megalithic. What it means is that entire rock surfaces, like natural rock, were carved into stairways, temples, very strange shapes, as you find at Texcocingo, for instance, not far from Mexico City, or at Malinalco, where entire temples were dug out of the living rock. Something pretty unique, again, in Mesoamerica. I think the only parallels you can probably find in Peru and South America, where we can also find a very similar style of workmanship.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the pyramids at Teotihuacan. For those of you who don't know, in the late 1800s, a businessman, Leopoldo Beatriz, got permission from the Mexican government to begin excavating the Pyramid of the Sun. This is a monstrosity of a pyramid. It's huge. It has the base, the same footprint as the Giza pyramid in Egypt, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this because I have read a lot about Beatrice's kind of ripshaw technique of just ripping everything across the surface, and he found volumes of mica, a reflective mineral on the surface. But I'm wondering, is it your belief that maybe when he was excavating, he may have excavated the original outer coating, which may have been megalithic stone? What is your feeling on that?
Yeah, that's quite interesting, actually, that you raise this point. Of course, Batres excavating at the beginning of the 1900s was also motivated by nationalistic purposes. Of course,
right.
We should not forget that was a time when Mexico was ruled by Porfirio Diaz, who had a very keen interest in reviving Mexico's mythical past and building a sense of national identity. So these enormous monuments of the past certainly played a role in this nation building effort. Leopoldo Batres, in that sense, was perfectly a man of his time. I think we can hardly call archaeology those early excavations at Teotihuacan. It was a mix of imaginative reconstruction and just plain looking of the ancient site. So what we see today, the reconstructed pyramids, are really more of a representation of what people of that time thought this pyramid would have looked like in antiquity than the actual building itself. We have a number of old engravings from the 1600s, 1700s that show the pyramids of Teotihuacan still covered in a stone casing, which is something quite fascinating. There are particularly these drawings that did from the 1700s by Alzate, among others, and Dupé, that very clearly depict a stone casing on the outside of the pyramids. It even describes some very large megalithic stone blocks there. Of course, what happened to these stones is a matter of speculation. The most likely explanation is that they were just scraped and reused in modern construction, or probably sold off as construction material, at least whatever was left of the original casing of the pyramid. That's part of the reason why what was left under the stone casing has been rapidly deteriorating. And that's the reason why Batres then had to restore, I would say quite arbitrarily, the pyramid using lots of concrete and stucco just to preserve whatever was left of the original core after the casing was removed.
Yeah, I haven't been there, but when I see close-ups that friends and associates send me, photographs of the pyramid today, it looks like they use smaller stones and concrete to reinforce and to solidify what's left of all three pyramids, Pyramid of the Sun, Pyramid of the Moon, and the Serpent Pyramid. Is that what you believe has been done?
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, it was quite shocking for the archaeological community when excavations carried out at the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpents started from the 30s and through the 40s and 50s, uncovered a massive stone facade for the pyramid itself that had remained buried under later reconstruction. So the only reason why this beautiful stone facade of the Feathered Serpents pyramid survived to this day is that it was buried under later reconstructions. Otherwise, we probably have never heard of these beautiful decorations. And it's very likely that this was no exception. Probably all of the pyramids at Teotihuacan originally had a stone casing that was later removed.
Well, let me ask you about that. You have a number of photographs on your website showing what looks like outer casing or major stones, square stones, cornerstones, exquisitely carved and cut stones that are like placed on top of like a little pyramid to kind of highlight them. Is that the purpose of the archaeologist to do that so people can see them, or did they want to just make sure that no one walked off with them? I don't think it's going to be a possibility, but
yeah. I think this is probably one of the best hidden secrets, so to say, of Teotihuacan. It's not that it's an area which is off limits to the public, really. I think you can very easily walk there, or just very few people take the hassle of walking all the way around the citadel to get to the area where these large megalithic stones are found. And the archaeologists certainly made an effort, if I can say so, to kind of many of these large megalithic stones are found still embedded in the masonry of the pyramid itself, or perhaps like placed on piles of loose stone. That's basically the same situation, same context in which they were found, which is something I found very puzzling, because that can mean two different things. It can mean, on the one hand, that these stone blocks were certainly already ancient by the time the later stages of construction of the pyramid were built, so that they were reused as a filling for the pyramid itself. Or it could mean that these blocks belong to some even earlier structure that existed there before the pyramid. And so what we see as the what we think or we consider the megalithic casing of the pyramid itself does in fact already reuse blocks that were already ancient, might have belonged to an entirely different type of structure.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you found any buildings that are megalithic in size at Teotihuacan or any kind of construction that is consistent with building or?
Well, not many still standing buildings. There are definitely a large number of stone blocks, very large megalithic stone blocks. They were reused in later construction. It's very clear that these blocks were reused. So you can see, for instance, some of their sites have carvings and hieroglyphics in some cases have been able to photograph on the surface of these blocks that are found like in position where you would not have been able to see any of these carvings. Basically, it's very clear they were in secondary use in this structure. What is fascinating is that there are a number of places at Teotihuacan where you can still see a number of these megalithic stone blocks in their original context in their original position, particularly under the so-called Palace of Quetzalpapalotla. It's one of the largest palaces in Teotihuacan, very close to the Pyramids of the Moon. You can actually visit an under-level kind of basement under the building where archaeologists have uncovered an earlier layer of construction. So the palace itself was rebuilt several times. And what is interesting is that the earlier level of constructions are megalithic. They employ very large blocks of stone, very finely fitted and joined together. And then you see in the later levels above it that the quality of construction just deteriorates. These megalithic stone blocks disappear. They're replaced with smaller, loose stones, stuccoed surfaces, until you just have very, very simple architecture.
Yeah, you have some wonderful photographs of these stones and these megaliths. And also the earlier construction is revealed. Is it the guess of the archaeologists that the later civilizations would cover up early construction and build over it, or what is the thought behind why that would be done?
So there is lots of speculation. One possibility is that the city itself was built in stages under different political forms of government. So there is this theory among archaeologists that in the early times of Teotihuacan, the city itself was ruled by kind of theocratic elite that was overturned at some point, so that many of the buildings were set on fire. There is evidence of widespread destruction in many areas of the city, so that many, particularly of the palatial quarters, the pyramids and the temples, were later rebuilt, although in a much cruder form, I would say. But reality is that in many cases, like it's the case of these megalithic stone blocks at the Pyramid of the Feathered Serpents, there is just no viable explanation as to why these beautiful carved blocks would have been thrown in the filling of a later pyramid at the stage which is already supposed to be one of the earliest in the construction of Teotihuacan. So it really makes you wonder what was there before the city itself was built in the form we know now.
Yeah, I mean, this is why this article you wrote, and by the way, the article's The Rome of America, What Lies Under Teotihuacan, The Real City of the Gods, wonderful article. I just never realized that there were these stones laying around, and it's like they're an afterthought. It's like they have not been looked at or reasoned where they came from, because they seem so odd. They're very out of place when you look at what's standing right now at Teotihuacan, the current construction. So, wonderful, wonderful idea. Do we know if anybody in the archaeological community is carrying out any kind of research? Let's see, that's the National Institute of Anthropology and History, that group. Are they doing anything about it, or is it more just, hey, these megaliths are here, and we're not going to take it much further because we don't know what to do about it?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think the National Institute of Archaeology and Anthropology, INA, is doing an incredible job at just preserving the archaeological and historical heritage of Mexico.
Yeah.
However, what you also find is that there is a kind of neglect for those remains that are more difficult to explain from a traditional, conventional archaeological point of view. And that's really the only explanation I can find for the abandonment and neglect of many of these early megalithic sites. Even at Teotihuacan itself, there is not a single sign that would point you to the location of these stones or that would explain why they're even there. But there is plenty talking about the frescoes or the stacked surfaces, many of like the later and perhaps like simpler forms of expression of Teotihuacan civilization. This seems like, it really sounds like archaeologists are almost deliberately almost choosing to not deal with these anomalous remains, so just because this could open the door to an entirely different picture of the past.
I always wonder when it comes to academic archaeology if it has a budgetary situation. We run into this in America where there could be a real interesting site, but they just can't pursue it because there's no funding to go out there and do the research and do the excavation. So perhaps this is the same thing for Mexican archaeologists. What do you think?
Yeah, that's clearly a possibility, and there are lots of course, like funding is a very big issue in academia and traditional archaeologists. It's not surprising that lots of funding will be diverted to, let's say, even just like plain preservation of ancient sites. There is, of course, like investigation going on, even a number of fascinating investigation projects going on at Teotihuacan, like the exploration of the tunnels under a pyramid of feathered serpents. But these are, I would say, like pretty limited compared to the opportunity you have to really uncover many of the lost pages of Mesoamerican history.
Yeah, and as we know, the conquistadors destroyed volumes of codices and other manuals, so we don't know the history or any of the science of any of these people. Can you give our audience an idea of what we're talking about size-wise for some of these megaliths? Are they like 4 feet by 8 feet and they weigh an average of 10 tons, or are they just a variety of different sizes?
Yeah, they're really a variety of different sizes and shapes as well. So some of them clearly appear to have belonged to some sort of architectural frieze or decoration, because they're very heavily, they have like very beautiful, very refined sculptures on their surfaces. Well, some other of the blocks are just like very plain, very regular stone blocks, beautifully carved, but without any decoration. Some of the larger ones, I would estimate, they can measure very easily 2 meters by side, which is about like 6 feet by side, and probably as you say, like probably weigh around 10 tons. What is even more interesting is that, as you say, this stone, which is on the site, is not a local stone. It's not a native stone from the region of Teotihuacan. So it must have been brought there from quarries that were located probably as much as 25 kilometers away. So we're really speaking of a major engineering feat to bring these huge stones to Teotihuacan. And there is also evidence that even larger stones were employed. I will give you 2 examples. One is the so-called water goddess monolith. It's a huge andesite monolith that was found very near the Pyramid of the Moon in Teotihuacan. It's currently in the National Museum of Anthropology in Mexico City. That weighs around 20 tons. It's one of the largest stones that were found in situ at Teotihuacan. And then you have the truly massive Kotlin Chan monolith that was found in the quarry near Mount Tlaloc, that weighs in excess of 170 tons, which makes it one of the largest monoliths in the Americas, and was almost certainly meant to be carried to Teotihuacan. We don't know for what reason it was abandoned in the quarries, but it seems very likely it must have been some sort of perhaps political upheaval that caused work on the monolith to stop.
Yeah, you know, it's funny about that monolith. It's huge, over 100 tons. But it seems to me that whoever was carving it was very, very, a very poor sculptor, because it's a very kind of mishmash of execution in terms of its look. It's a very unattractive idol, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wonder if it's one of the later groups that actually carved it. It's just I'm actually going to post it on the Facebook page. It isn't very attractive at all, but I've seen it at the National Anthropological Museum in Mexico City. It's huge.
Yeah. Well, what you need to think is that very often when the ancient builders would carry these stones from the quarry to the construction site, so in this case to Teotihuacan, they would carry the monolith still in the rough so that the decorations would not get damaged. So that's the reason why the monolith, of course, Lincheon still has this kind of rough, unfinished aspect. However, if you look at some of the details of the carving of the monolith itself, you find it's actually pretty sophisticated. Some of the surfaces are perfectly planar. There are like some very clear circular shapes. They're very, very precise, very accurate. The drill holes pierced through the monolith itself. So it shows that the tools employed, whatever they were pretty sophisticated. Of course, like you have to take into account hundreds, perhaps thousands of years of erosion as the monolith was left abandoned in the quarry. In effect, it was never completed. Might account for this kind of unfinished aspect. But from personal observation, I can guarantee that the stones that lie around at Teotihuacan show incredible, really astonishing workmanship. They have perfectly planar surfaces. Some of them show evidence of drilling and sowing, which is itself very puzzling for a civilization that supposedly only possessed very primitive stone tools.
Yeah, when I first visited the National Anthropological Museum, I went into the early Mexico period and saw these amazing carvings. They had animals that were beautifully rendered in mm-hmm. stone. It seems like the very ancient people were masters of stone carving mm-hmm. and very, very hard rocks, like the pre-dynastic and dynastic Egyptians. Mm-hmm. They were just experts in carving sure. and granite. And andesite's very hard to carve. So
it's
very curious.
It is an extremely hard stone. And I find lots of similarities, for instance, with early dynastic Egypt, where you also find this truly impressive megalithic construction and the total lack of the tools that would have been employed to carve these stone blocks. There are a number of exhibits in the Teotihuacan Site Museum of small obsidian chisels and pounding stones that would have been totally inadequate to the task of shaping these enormous andesite stone blocks. And again, you always find this megalithic evidence in the earlier layers and stages of construction. You find this in Egypt. You find it at Teotihuacan. It's even more puzzling in the case of Teotihuacan because there was nobody before them. It was one of the earliest Mesoamerican civilizations. You have to go back to the time of the Olmecs to find stone sculpture and stone architecture on a similar scale.
Right. That's been a big question for a lot of people when they go and they see sophisticated carvings like in Egypt, and I see it throughout Mesoamerica. You know, there's a lost technology. There's a lost science that's gone that we don't know about. But the evidence is in these sculptures. There's no way that these things were cut with stone rocks, and they would have us believe it was rock on rock, but that's just, you're not going to carve anything of any sophistication. So there's a missing book on the technology of the ancient past. Hey, I want to get into the tunnels, and this is a big part of the interest in this article. Your second article was called "Descending into the Underworld of Teotihuacan,"
mm-hmm.
and you reported many. What appears to be miles of underground tunnels. Now, how long have we known about these tunnels? How long have they been documented?
Well, that's what is really crazy in my mind, because these tunnels and knowledge of these tunnels has been around basically forever. They've never really been forgotten. You have, of course, like the first European or Western explorations of these tunnels date to the 1800s, and they've only been scientifically and systematically excavated beginning in the last couple of decades, which is even more astonishing. So the first, let's say, scientific reports of these tunnels date to the late 1800s, when these French archaeologists, Désiré Charnay, was the first to report their existence in the region around Teotihuacan. He was himself able to explore large portions of the tunnel network, which extended for miles under the ancient site. he also collected reports and local legends of some of these tunnels running for as much as 40 miles on a straight line to some of the nearby towns. And even the portions of the tunnels that are visible today extend for hundreds of meters, perhaps kilometers, if they were not blocked by cave-ins and other types of obstructions.
Mm-hmm. So are there noted entrance ways and exit ways that start, say, close to the entrance of Teotihuacan? Or how are they formed? How are these tunnels made? Are they man-made tunnels or natural?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are at least a couple of known entrances, and you would be surprised by how easily accessible they are. There are no signs, so no signposts would lead you there, but there are not even like fences or any barrier to prevent you from entering. They're just there. Most visitors to the site just don't even know or don't even suspect that they exist. So one of the entrances is located around 200 meters to the east of the Pyramid of Sun. It's a vast complex of caves and man-made tunnels that can very easily lead even under the pyramid itself and in many other directions. Then you have an additional entrance to the tunnels, which is located some 3 kilometers to the west of the Pyramid of the Moon. And these are the tunnels that were originally explored by Charnay, who believed to have been able to follow some of them until under the Pyramid of the Moon itself. There is lots of debate on the origin of these tunnels. I think for a long while it was believed that these were simple lava tunnels. So basically the entire region is volcanic. So it is likely that some of these massive prehistoric eruptions left behind some lava tunnels. However, what is fascinating is that recent research, and I'm speaking of research dating to the early 2000s, has conclusively proven that these tunnels are indeed man-made. So these are no natural tunnels. There are a number of beautiful articles by these Mexican archaeologists, Linda Manzanilla from the National Institute of Anthropology, that cover at least portions of these tunnels in which she categorically excludes that the tunnels are natural. They must have been man-made. And that poses the question of why would the ancient builders of Teotihuacan, or perhaps some earlier people, build literally miles of tunnels? There has been research from this Mexican archaeologist, Linda Manzanilla, on this tunnel. It has categorically proven that the tunnels themselves are man-made. So these are not natural cave formations, as was believed in the first place. For many decades, people believed these were simple lava tunnels left behind by some prehistoric volcanic eruption, but in fact, these are entirely man-made. And of course, this poses the question of the purpose for which this labyrinthine system of tunnels, this enormous underground maze, was built.
Now, I found in my research on the Pyramid of the Serpent that the tunnel that runs underneath the pyramid was used for some form of chemical combination, chemical reaction. They found large quantities of not only mercury, they found pyrite balls. The main archaeologist involved in the excavation, Pedro Gomez, also found radon gas being passed in there in different areas. And huge quantities of water were funneled into that, into the tunnel that led directly underneath the pyramid. Did you find any similar evidence of any chemical combinations under either the Pyramid of the Moon or the Pyramid of the Sun?
Well, it's not really known. The tunnels under both pyramids are very poorly explored. There are reports of tunnels extending under the Pyramid of the Moon, but these have not been explored in modern times. And the only tunnel which is known under the Pyramid of the Sun is this, it's about 150 meters long tunnel that takes two small chamber, which is pretty much in the shape of a clover, that was believed to have been associated with some sort of ritual. It's interesting that, particularly in the tunnels under the Pyramid of the Sun, some fragments and slabs of mica were found. So this might also suggest that this tunnel didn't just have a simple ceremonial function. But of course, there is the possibility or just scraping the surface of the site, there might be an entire other layer, another level of tunnels, much deeper the level of tunnels have been explored so far. That's not a fringe hypothesis, as it might sound, because very serious archaeologists advanced it. René Millon, one of the main excavators of Teotihuacan in the 50s, speculated that some enormous chambers existed under the Pyramid of the Sun, because he had found evidence through trenches and other tunnels dug through the core masonry of the pyramid itself, that some huge pits were dug into the solid rock and then filled up. Of course, we don't know where these pits would lead, but it's very possible there is an entire level of tunnels much deeper than the ones that are currently being explored, that could potentially reveal a lot about the origins of the city itself.
Let's talk about that. I have a map that was made of the tunnel that runs underneath the Pyramid of the Sun, and it's very curious because it runs directly underneath the pyramid, but as it's going towards the center, there's various small rooms that have been excavated out of solid rock, and nobody has an explanation for why they would carve these small rooms. Now, the Pyramid of the Serpent has similar rooms, but they're not cut sideways. They're cut below the running main tunnel canal that runs underneath the pyramid. Do we have any new knowledge of why they would do this, or if they were running water with chemicals or some kind of a system to do something? It's just very odd.
Yeah, there is lots of speculation, definitely, like lots of, I would say, strange or unusual materials at Teotihuacan. One we already mentioned, it's mica. It was found in a number of places, both under the Pyramid of the Sun, also in the casing of the Pyramid of the Sun itself, which is quite interesting, in a number of other places around Teotihuacan, like this famous mica chamber. There is a pyrite, as you mentioned, like a number of pyrite spherules, probably hundreds, were found in those tunnels under the Pyramid of Feathered Serpents, and then there is liquid mercury. So these are not materials that are commonly found at the ancient sites. It suggests some there must be some pretty sophisticated explanation for their presence at Teotihuacan. And again, another thing which is interesting is the use of water on the site. It's very clear that at a number of places, particularly around the mica chamber under the Pyramid of the Sun, water was meant to flow through these tunnels. There are a number of conduits and pipes that run under the floor of the buildings, which seem to have served some sort of technical function. It was perhaps associated with the presence of these mica layer or these unusual materials.
Wow, that's fascinating to hear that. So those apartments had running water of some kind? So maybe they weren't actual living quarters. Maybe they were some kind of scientific stations of some kind.
I think particularly in the case of the mica chamber, there is strong evidence that this might have been the case. This is a small room located on one side of the Avenue of the Dead. This was excavated over the course of the 60s and the 70s, so in pretty recent times. And a mica floor was found, which is pretty startling discovery. However, what is more interesting is that under this mica floor, there is an entire network of pipes and water channels that don't make really any sense, because they were basically sealed under the floor, unless one thinks that the use of this room might have been technical. It's not hard to imagine that this some kind of reaction or process would have taken place in this room, generating large amounts of heat, which would have required refrigeration by means of the water running underneath the floor. It's a well-known fact that mica is used as a thermal insulator in a number of electrical and even nuclear applications. So it's not that unlikely that the reason why mica is found in those places is that some type of technological process took place there, which used water as a moderator or as a cooler for these type of reactions.
Hmm. Is it anyone's hypothesis or theory that some of those tunnels may have been used to carry water in and out through the central area of Teotihuacan?
That's a possibility. However, I don't find it that, particularly if we're talking about the larger tunnels, I don't find it that that likely. I think these tunnels were definitely meant to be walked. So these were like large tunnels that would lead to a number of chambers. Of course, we don't know really what was the use, what was the purpose of these tunnels, but they don't really show any hydraulic feature. Like, for instance, typically you would imagine to see waterproofing or some sort of plaster on the walls just to retain water, which you don't really find in the larger tunnels. So I really believe that they were used as either as a way of connecting through underground passages the pyramids, or they might even lead to some sort of yet undiscovered chamber or some other sort of ancient repository under the pyramids.
Hmm. You know, you've mentioned that twice, that you have seen evidence of possible additional chambers that were covered up in later years. So that is interesting that there could be, in your estimation, an even deeper tunnel system that runs underneath existing tunnels that may have been used for conveying water or some other elements.
Yeah. And I think it's a very natural conclusion if you think about the geology of a place. Basically, there is a very hard natural bedrock, which is mostly basalt or andesite. And then on top of it, you find a volcanic layer, which consists of petrified volcanic eject, lots of ash, for instance, and loose volcanic stone that was left by pyroclastic flows. So most of the tunnels you can currently explore are dug through these volcanic layer. So that's the reason why they appear very dilapidated nowadays. They are very poorly preserved just because the quality of the material was very poor. It's like very loose and very fragile lava stone overall, which of course it made it easier to carve these tunnels, but also made them very fragile and subject to caving. However, there is a suggestion, particularly in the reports written in the 1800s by Charney, that some of these tunnels would connect with an even deeper network that was dug through the solid bedrock, so through andesite or basalt under the city itself, which might have been part of the reason why these later towns were built, simply as a way of connecting with this older network that lay buried before volcanic eruptions covered them up.
Hmm, fascinating. You know, I want your opinion about what I found, because you actually live there. I wrote an article called Uncovering Ancient Pyramid Science at Teotihuacan, Where Men Become Gods. And I actually looked at a number of reports that Pedro Gomez wrote in what he had discovered underneath the Pyramid of the Serpent. And to my mind, based on the chemicals that they were able to analyze, and it's unfortunate, by the way, that they didn't have a chemist or an engineer or somebody down there with them to kind of look at this, the way the tunnel was cut and what was how it was used. But it seems like there was some form of combustion being emitted from that tunnel. Now, we don't have an idea of how it was created or whatever, but some of the early excavation photographs of Gomez actually going through a cement tube that originates at the surface down into this tunnel led me to believe that there was some kind of reaction that was formulated underneath this tunnel. Now, what do you have to say about that? Is it, do you have any feeling about, because you actually present some interesting evidence about the amount of mercury, liquid mercury, mm-hmm. that's found in that tunnel. What do you say?
Yeah, so definitely the presence of liquid mercury is puzzling. There are very, very few examples of liquid mercury found at ancient sites, just because the process required for the extraction of liquid mercury and even the handling of it as a toxic substance is a very complex process. It's also interesting that you mentioned the possibility of some sort of, thermal reaction occurring there. Because from my personal experience, many of the large megalithic stones that are found in that same area show evidence of it having been subject to extremely intense heat. And I find it very, very interesting and quite curious that the conventional explanation of archaeologists is that it was caused by some sort of devastating fire that consumed the city. And that's what I found amusing, because it seems very unlikely to me that somebody would have taken the hassle of deliberately trying to burn stone, particularly these enormous blocks of stone. This is not something that a conventional fire would do. You need to be pretty deliberate about that. And you will require some very intense heat to split andesite or to cause the kind of damage that you see on some of the megalithic stones. So it's very well possible that some other explanation might have been involved, which also could very well relate to the reason for the ultimate destruction and abandonment of Teotihuacan, which also appears to have been due to some sort of fiery catastrophe or a devastating fire.
Well, I've always felt in my research that Teotihuacan was a generation. It was some kind of energy generator. It was not a place where people lived, and it supplied the local area. What we don't know the physics behind any kind of reaction. We don't know the science behind it because we have no documentation. And if, in fact, the original builders were 10,000 years or older, say 20,000 years, very, very ancient people, when they died off through whatever calamity, those who repopulated the buildings made them their own and may have covered up the original stonework and the buildings. And what we see and what current archaeologists interpret as the builders were actually land settlers who had no clue about the people in the past. And I think that goes for a lot of Mesoamerican ancient buildings, that they were resettled. What do you say about that?
Yeah, I think particularly in the case of Teotihuacan, there is a strong evidence, particularly in the form of these megalithic structures, that the city itself could be even thousands of years older than what is commonly assumed or accepted. And I think an entirely different picture of the Mesoamerican past emerges from it. So if we assume that this megalithic civilization existed thousands of years before the accepted chronology, then you would consider the later inhabitants of Teotihuacan as newcomers or later settlers, which is precisely what you find in ancient Aztec and Mesoamerican myths. They speak of Teotihuacan as a place that existed since time immemorial, basically since the time of creation. There are a number of creation stories that relate to the creation of the present world at Teotihuacan, at the time when the world was still in darkness. And then you have stories about the arrival of a new and still pretty mysterious people who probably knew of the existence of Teotihuacan and somehow tried either to rebuild it or to restore it to its original functionality. These were perhaps the original gods, the original companions of Quetzalcoatl, were said to have come to Mexico and built cities there. And in turn, these people left, leaving behind just the general population that very quickly declined into a less civilized state.
Yeah. Now, we know that Teotihuacan is kind of aligned to a star constellation. I can't remember which one it was, but whoever built it had an understanding of the cosmos. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, there are a number of theories around that. Some authors have suggested an Orion-Orion correlation theory very similar to the one that's been applied to the three pyramids of Giza,
yeah.
Which I find quite plausible given the relative size and distance of the pyramids. There is another model that claims that Teotihuacan was built as a scale model of the solar system, in which the citadel with the pyramid of feathered serpents would basically be built as a representation of the sun, the inner solar systems, with pyramids or other place marks placed at regular distance from the sun, which had been mostly the work of Hugh Harleston on Teotihuacan. And there is definitely lots of metrology and secret geometry involved in the general layout of Teotihuacan, which is clear evidence some very sophisticated people were behind, if not the construction, at least the design of Teotihuacan and of its layout.
Yeah, exactly. We know that when the Spanish arrived in the New World, which is Mexico, they did whatever they could to stamp out evidence of early sophisticated people, and they covered a great deal, especially Mexico City. Mexico mm-hmm. City sits on top of a lot of ancient ruins. And it seems like there's more and more evidence and there's discoveries every time someone goes drilling or tries to fix a deep pipe or underground buildings that were there. But when I go to Yucatan, one of the things that I find quite unique is that the newer generations of Maya, those that lived 800 to 1,000 years ago, would sanctify earlier construction and actually either build on top of it or modify the buildings and enhance them. We know this because the El Castillo, the castle at Chichen Itza, there's three other pyramids within it. So there was a very early version, and then there's later. But do you find that in parts of Mexico City and around that there's earlier construction on top of, or later on construction on top of earlier foundations and buildings?
Mm-hmm. And you also find it at Teotihuacan, because if you think that the Aztecs came into the scene during the course of the 14th century, and by the time the Aztecs arrived in the Valley of Mexico, Teotihuacan had been in ruins for almost 1,000 years. So they were impressed by these ruins. They called it, they gave it the name of Teotihuacan, which means quite literally the city of the gods.
Yeah.
They had no idea of who the builders of the place had originally been, and they sanctified it. They made it a central piece of their creation stories. And they had legends of this earlier race, which they called the Toltecs, this mysterious builder race who was responsible for the construction of all of these mysterious ruins whose origins the Aztecs did not understand. But with later Mesoamerican civilization, there was still a worship, a kind of veneration for these mysterious remains of the past. So it's known, for instance, that the great Aztec emperor Moctezuma would go on pilgrimages to Teotihuacan as the seat of his ancestors. Of course, it was not... That was not the case with the Spanish invaders. There are reports from the time of the conquest of this fanatic bishop, Zumarraga, who upon visiting Teotihuacan decided to throw down all the great statues and the idols that at the time were still standing on top of the pyramids and used fire to burn the stones to the ground, to dust.
Hold on a second. You mean we have another Diego de Landa, but he's in central Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. There are actually a number of accounts during the 16th century.
These Catholic priests just went nuts on these. They must have been shocked and dismayed at the sophistication of what they saw and just decided to go nuts and destroy. What was this guy's name, this priest's name again?
Zumarraga. He was a former bishop of Mexico. And you have both sides, because on the one hand you have some fanatics acting on behalf of the Catholic Church at the time, who systematically tried to eradicate evidence of these past, which they considered demoniac. And on the other hand, you had just the greed of the conquistadores, who believed that these pyramids were the tombs of great lords and that the enormous treasure could be found inside those pyramids. So if you put the two together, you end up with an almost complete eradication of indigenous cultures and the ancient past of an entire nation.
I find it fascinating. Well, I shouldn't even use the... I find it sad that the Mexican people today think that Diego de Landa is a wonderful man who brought Christianity and good tidings to Mexico. And then when I visit Mexico, there's a number of hotels that are named after him, and I want to burn them down. I don't think the people of Mexico understand what a tragedy these priests befell the natives of their country. They did us a horrible disservice.
Yeah, the flip side, at least in the case of Diego de Landa, is that thanks to him, we know something of Maya writing and civilization, because after burning books and destroying so many of the priceless Maya codexes, he kind of repented later in life and preserved perhaps the only account of Maya hieroglyphics and Maya writing that has survived to this day. So you have kind of an example of a repented sinner, if you want.
I've read his book, and it's not that good. I think the guy, he helped us with a little bit of information, but what a horrible genocide of knowledge, complete eradication, so thorough that we have four codices and a few sheets of paper for thousands of years. So anyhow,
of course, you would speak of the burning of the destruction of the Library of Alexandria, but there were vast libraries in the pre-Columbian world. For instance, even in central Mexico, the Library of the Kings of Texcoco, just outside of Mexico City, was renowned throughout the land. Netzahualcoyotl, when he was king of Texcoco, collected all kind of rare manuscripts and books in his library, probably held tens of thousands. It was also burned down by the conquistadors when they first came to Mexico. And nobody knows what kind of priceless information would have been able to gather from these codexes, many of which would have dated from the very early centuries after Christ, or perhaps even earlier.
Wow. Yeah. It's really it's horrible to hear about. Listen, why don't you give us your website and contact information, because I want people to be able to see your photographs and your research, because some of your photographs are just outstanding.
Sure. I have my own blog. It's called Uncharted Ruins. You can find it at the URL unchartedruins.blogspot.com, and I try to post reports of my expeditions to a number of places, not only in Mexico, but also in South America, some sites in Europe, Southeast Asia, particularly dedicated to ancient megalithic civilizations. And I have a project of publishing a more comprehensive study, a book on the subject of the origin of megalithic civilization and their diffusion around the world.
Fantastic. And you mentioned to me that you're going to be completing the contents of a book. We'll have to make sure we have you on the show again. And you're not leaving Mexico City anytime soon, I understand.
So. Not anytime soon. So you should expect to find more reports of ruins and other interesting sites, constantly planning new expeditions.
Fantastic. Well, Marco, thank you for your time. This has been really insightful. There's a lot of stuff I didn't know. I got to get down to Teotihuacan at least in the next 24 months just to do some walking around there. Now, I doubt that you can actually go into the tunnels that are around there. They're probably off limits. Is that correct?
Some of them are, some of them aren't. But if you come down here, I can very happily take you to some of the accessible ones.
Yeah, we should think about a tour. too many people, but maybe a handful of people take them and show them some of these places.
Yeah, we'll be happy to be your guide.
Fantastic. All right, Marco, thank you very much. It's been wonderful. And hey, get that book going. We want to see details of the book.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Cliff. I will keep you posted.
Good deal. Thanks again. So that was Marco Vigato. One of the things that he mentioned that I wanted to talk about real quickly is the discovery of andesite stone used in the megalithic construction, these blocks. And it seems like there is a worldwide focus on this hard, hard stone. We see it in Egypt. We see it in Peru. There's a number of very old sites in Indonesia that have that are completely built from andesite. And it appears that, you know, I don't know, 5, 10, 20,000 years ago, that was the stone of preference in building a lot of these structures. And it should be noted that, and I don't know anyone who talks about it, perhaps Graham Hancock talks about it in his book, but you know, was this a knowledge of cutting, stone cutting, that was handed down? We just don't know. There's so much about ancient history we just do not know. But that was fun talking with Mark. It was very, very knowledgeable. His articles are on ancientorigins.net. I've posted a couple on my Facebook page, and he's got a new article coming out in a couple of weeks that, well, I shouldn't talk about it. It's something that's pretty interesting. As a reminder, I am a regular contributing writer to Ancient Origins magazine, and I really recommend that you keep an eye on the articles in there. It's very, very closely aligned with what we do here on Earth Ancients podcast. And I really like their people. They're very heads up and very focused, and it's good material. Next week, I want to remind you, we're going to be looking at the Anunnaki. We're going to have Chris Hardy back on again. She's got a book on Anunnaki machinery, technology, and weaponry. And she's written a whole book about this. So it's all about Anunnaki next week. So as a reminder, always go to the Facebook Earth Ancients page, and I'm constantly writing there and checking things out. And I hope you'll join me for the Mexico, Maya in Mexico, October 28th through November 4th, is almost half off. I think I mentioned this before. It was close to $3,000 last time we were working on this. Now it's down to about $1,600. Doesn't include your flight, but it's very reasonable. And we're going to see a lot of really cool places. And I think you'd really have a great time. All touring and air conditioning buses. We're going to go at a time of the year where it's not very hot, so it'll be nice. Go to earthancients.com. You see the entire itinerary. Okay, that's it for today's show, and have a great week. And it's June, so get outside. Take care.
Hurry into Old Navy today and tomorrow to get jeans for the whole family on sale. Just $15 for adults, $12 for kids. Plus, starting today, redeem your Supercash to save even more at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Supercash valid 6/3 to 6/11. Jeans valid 6/3 to 6/4. Select styles only. Hurry into Old Navy today and tomorrow to get jeans for the whole family on sale. Just $15 for adults, $12 for kids. Plus, starting today, redeem your Supercash to save even more at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Supercash valid 6/3 to 6/11. Jeans valid 6/3 to 6/4. Select styles only.